Hello, everyone. Andrew here. I just got word about an exciting opportunity with a deadline of this Friday, August 14th. So I am breaking into this already edited and produced episode to tell you about it. Master the Endgame Bootcamp starts on Monday, August 17th, but applications close on Friday the 14th, and you can get 10% off when you sign up with code THINKINGPOKER, all one word. Master the Endgame is an 8-day bootcamp whose instructors include Stoyan Obreshkov, who was our guest on episode 448 of this show and is one of my personal favorite creators of instructional MTT content. He is a brilliant player and great at explaining complex concepts. If you are curious about that, I would encourage you to listen to episode 448. I think it is one of the very best strategy-focused episodes, interviews in particular, that we have done. Master the Endgame is an 8-day online camp focused on ICM theory, exploitative strategy, and mental game, which I can tell you is a very big deal when you are deep in a big poker tournament. However solid you think your endgame, your mental game may be at other stages of a poker tournament or other times when you're playing poker, it really is a different story when you are deep in a big tournament. And of course, you want to be at your sharpest for those moments. You can find full details about the academy at finaltable.academy. And remember to use Thinking Poker, all one word, to get a 10% discount when you sign up.
Danger is stealing in as relapse comes above the den. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 503 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Catonsville, Maryland, I am Andrew Brokus.
And from Jacksonville, Florida, I'm Carlos Welch.
It's going to be just the two of us today. We are mostly going to be talking strategy. I do want to give a shout out, though. At the time that we're recording this, the WSOP main event has not quite concluded, but we are down to... I actually don't even know. Is it two or three players remaining now?
I don't know.
We're down to a very small number of players.
Oh, wait a minute. Okay. You said two or three. I know you did tell me that guys got fourth, but usually I think they go 9-6 and then 6-3. So it's probably three left.
But yeah, Gags is the main thing that I wanted to shout out. Michael Gagliano, aka Gags 30, was a guest on this show. I just know it's been over 10 years. It was January 18th, 2016 was when that episode released. I remember being in Montreal when I interviewed him. And yeah, it was, I really enjoyed talking to him, and I remember having the thought, and obviously it's been 10 years and I hadn't pulled the trigger on it, but I was like, oh, he was really cool. I'm going to get him back on the show sometime. So hopefully this will be the impetus for that. But I was very excited to see him make the final table and end up doing as well as he did. I mean, partly because I hope people will go back and listen to the interview. I remember it being a good one, but also he just seemed like a good guy like you. He's a former teacher. Just, you know, a guy who's been around the poker world for a long time, just sort of a quiet, gets the job done sort of guy. I had a very favorable impression of him.
I didn't know he was a teacher. Maybe I need to go back and re-listen to that interview. I'm partial to ex-teachers in poker. Like, there was a guy that I used to follow years ago. I wonder if he's still around. I think he was in Canada. His name was Ryan Hall.
He's been a guest on the show too.
Yeah, he was a teacher. Yeah. I have to go back and re-listen to Gag's interview, or like you said, hopefully talk to him soon.
Yeah. So if people do want to hear the original one, this episode 157, I have not listened to it since I recorded it 10 years ago. My recollection is that it was good. So I think I'm probably right about that, but I think you will enjoy hearing Gag's on episode 157. Other exciting news, we have a new sponsor for the show, the site called GTO Dojo. GTO Dojo is an app for learning and drilling GTO poker strategy. It is a place not just to study theory, but to put in reps. Of course, Sovereign Concepts are great. Carlos and I talk about them all the time on the show. That's the main thing that I study these days. But you need repeated practice to turn those concepts into actionable insights. Studying the theory alone is not enough. And that's exactly what you can get at GTO Dojo. It's free to start, so please check it out using the link gtodojo.com/thinking. That's gtodojo.com/thinking. So we've got a couple of strategy questions today. Carlos, do you want to start with the theory one that you pulled up?
Yes. All right. So we'll start with Sean's theory question. Sean says, by the way, Sean is our previous editor on this show, long-term editor. We have a new editor who's also Sean, but this is Sean Lango, which you can go back and listen to our episode with him called Papa Sean, because he left to start a pizza shop. I always love the name of that episode. But shout out to Sean. He has a theory question where he says, I play somewhat regularly in an online 1-2 home game that is half No Limit Hold'em and half PLO. The usual lineup is me, one solid winning player, and 1 to 3 fairly loose recreational players, and one very gambly station who plays nearly every hand, has checked back the nuts on the river, and gets confused when it gets all in on the river and people don't run it twice. that is hilarious, man. I love it. I miss home game with people like home games with people like this. It reminds me of a guy I was in a home game with, and I'm sure I've said this on the show before, where that we were talking about poker books, and the guy said, "Why would I ever read a book if it's not going to tell me what's coming on the flop?" It's like, I just love some of the people in these home games, man. But anyway, Sean continues. The buy-in for this game is between $100 and $500, and the typical stacks often start around 50 to 100 big blinds deep. As the game progresses, it's common for rebuys to skew larger and to have stacks at the table ranging from those lows up through the 400 to 1,000 big blind ranges. Wow. I consider this to be a very soft game where I can win even when autopiloting, but I'm finding myself excited at digging deeper into finding ways to make more in this environment. I'd love to hear you guys talk about what things you'd be looking for specifically if you found yourself in this game and how you'd use your findings to generate new exploits. This is not a HUD-friendly environment, and while this site generates hand histories of sorts, it would probably take some real time and AI wizardry to cobble together a database of the players in the game. But it seems like even if a database was out of the question, there's probably some combination of observation and inference that I could be getting better at here to find more edge. I'm curious to hear your thoughts. So, Andrew, how would you maximally exploit this very soft game that starts shallow and often winds up very deep?
I think the biggest thing that someone like Sean, who's already a pretty experienced and knowledgeable player, like the area where Sean probably has the least experience is with playing super deep, playing 400 plus big blinds deep. And there's both like theoretical things to think about and also psychological or exploitative kinds of things to think about. So just from an exploitative perspective, often, and this might not be the case with that whale, but you kind of want to know like which players are which. But a lot of people, if they run up a stack that big in that game, they're going to be very reluctant to put that entire stack into play. So I think as much as possible, you want to try to get a sense of like, how do people feel about playing really big pots, pots that might be like multiples of what they bought in for? And how is that affected by things like whether they're up on the night? If they were perfect poker playing robots, that wouldn't matter to them. But to a lot of humans, it does matter. If they're ahead $200, they don't want to play a pot where, sorry, 200 big blinds. They don't want to play a pot where they might lose 300 or 400 big blinds in one hand and go from like being solidly ahead on the night to like suddenly have a losing night, especially as the night turns towards the end. And the opposite could also be true, right? If they're stuck, they might be looking for an opportunity to play a big pot and try to get even. So I think understanding how, like, if these are regular opponents, understanding how they respond to being like ahead or behind and how reluctant they're going to be to play big pots is going to be super important. Like, there's going to be really powerful exploitative opportunities attached to this. If so and so just isn't going to play a big pot without the nuts, then you can orchestrate situations where that person is pretty unlikely to have the nuts and then just like make big bets at them. And you're going to have fold equity in this game that you might not be accustomed to having when you're playing at, say, the commerce. When it comes to just playing deep stacked in general, I think you need to experiment with using bigger raises and bigger bet sizes relative to the pot than what you are accustomed to. When you are three betting at a position, I would not bother with the large raises. You're going to be at a disadvantage when you're called no matter what. So you mostly don't want to be making big three bets from out of position. The reason to three bet, say, from the small blind is mostly to push the big blind out more so than to push an advantage against the original raiser, because being out of position and super deep, you're not really going to have that much of an advantage against the original raiser. You're not going to be doing much three betting from the big blind, period, in heads up pots. You might squeeze from the big blind to try to push some people out, but you're going to need to have a hand that'll play pretty well when it gets called, which usually is going to mean a hand that's drawing to the nuts or something close to it. So emphasis on like suited aces, suited and connected kinds of hands. Stuff like ace king offsuit goes way down in value. Small pocket pairs go down in value, because those are cases where even when you make the hand that you're sort of trying to make, you make like top pair, top kicker, or you make a low set, it might not be a good enough hand to play for stacks. That's the kind of thing you want to think about before you start building a big pot with those hands anyway. And then when you're in position three betting, you want to be making some big three bets, because for all the same reasons that I just said, you can't do a lot of three betting out of position. Your opponents can't do a lot of four betting out of position, which means when you make big three bets, they often respond by calling or folding. So these three bets could be as big as like, five, six, seven, eight times the original raise. Like, depending on how deep you are, kind of experiment with this. Like, assume that you're not be getting three bet, and experiment, or you're not gonna be getting four bet. Experiment with making some really large three bets. Same thing goes to like overbetting turns. You might experiment more with overbetting flops. Maybe not something that you're as accustomed to doing. Just look for situations where you have a nuts advantage, and then think about whether you have the kind of hand that might benefit from overbetting even as soon as the flop.
Yeah, that all makes sense to me. I would say focus even more than you normally would on capping your opponents, because that is going to allow you to get those additional folds for bigger bets on later streets when people are up a decent amount. The other thing I would say is maybe being a little bit more willing to call three bets light when you're in position, because these strike me as the sort of players that aren't going to be thinking about board coverage. They're probably not three betting a robust enough range. So when Andrew talks about when you're, say, 400 big blinds deep, something like ace king offsuit doesn't work great as a three bet, because even when you do three bet, you are not significantly decreasing the SPR, which is like the main thing that hand is looking to do when you three bet from out of position and more shallow stacks. You is looking to decrease the SPR and then get the big blind out if they're three betting that hand from the small blind. But now only half of that goal is being achieved. Yeah, you get the big blind out, but you could three bet, get called, and the SPR could still be like 10. And if that's the case, you really want to be in there with a wide range against players who are just not going to have better than one pair on a lot of runouts. And if you can combine that with their fear of getting all the money in, then that just seems like a pretty profitable situation to be in. Like if they're three betting from the small blind with stuff like ace king or even pocket aces, you call and the SPR is like 10 plus, and the board as it often does, runs out in a way where straights get there, flushes get there, and they have hands that don't make those sort of hands very often. That seems very, very profitable. So if you can create more of those situations by maybe calling three bets with a wider range than you're used to, I can see that being an exploitative opportunity as well.
Yeah, I think both looking for opportunities where your opponents are already capped, or also like when you mentioned capping them, there are also things you can do. Kind of like I think of this as like hungry horse sort of stuff, where if they don't raise you on a particular street, especially if you make a kind of smallish bet and they don't raise it, you can often assume that they're capped. And then if the river is not a card that uncaps them, that can be a good opportunity for a really large bet to then just like put a lot of pressure on that capped range.
Yeah, and when we say a really large bet, it might be bigger than you're used to thinking. Like, I can imagine spots where somebody three bets aces and the board runs out in a way like they know they don't want to get all the money in. So they might play kind of carefully with aces where they're just checking and calling. And they might be willing to check call bets up to like, 100% of the pot, maybe like 120% of the pot. So, like, these are spots where you can find like some 2 or 3x pot size bets and really put the screws to a guy who has one pair that they were willing to check call down with, but they didn't expect a bet that big. So that's the part that I think is strategically a great opportunity to look for in this game. But like Andrew said, there's some like psychological preparation you need to do ahead of time to be willing to pull the trigger in those spots in the first place. And then also like mentally survive if you pull the trigger in a spot like that and it doesn't work because it's not guaranteed, but you're just like playing the odds here. So you might have to work up to that. And I mean, this doesn't seem like there doesn't seem to be a lot of other places where you can get experience with this sort of thing for less money. I guess maybe you can play some smaller online games and like it's like even if you're playing like a 10 cent, 25 cent game online, it's going to be hard to run up stacks to where you're 400 effective. Even if you run up 400, to get someone else to also run up 400 and then not leave the table,
Yeah.
400 big blinds, I mean, is going to be difficult.
The time that I used to see that was in fast fold games, which I haven't played in a while, but it used to be the case that if you played like Zoom on Poker Stars, you could get into situations where there would be multiple rigs and there'd be several people who might have stacks in that neighborhood.
Okay. So yeah, that's what I always look to do when I'm about to learn and practice doing something that's outside of my comfort zone that requires putting in a lot more big blinds than I'm used to. I try to find a way to do that cheaper so that I can kind of like work the kinks out and make my mistakes that without causing myself a lot of money. And when I do that, I kind of develop experience to where I've seen this thing work in low stakes so often that I'm confident that it's a good play. And then when I try it in higher stakes, even if it doesn't work out, it doesn't negate that experience I've built. Because if you try this sort of thing for the first time in this game where you're playing for significant money and you just, put in $1,500 or $2,000 on a bluff to win like a $500 pot or whatever, and it fails the first time, you may be so shell shocked from that that you never try it again. Even if it was a perfect spot and you just happen to run into the one hand that the guy called you with, it's like, but if you do that in a smaller game and it works consistently, occasionally it won't work in that game, just like occasionally it won't work in a big game. But let's say if you run this play 20 times and it fails twice and then it works like the next 18 times. You're going to make it to those next 18 if you start by doing this in the smaller stakes. If you start trying this in the bigger stakes and it fails those first two times, you're never going to see the next 18 where it would have worked. So that's kind of like one little trick I try to use to kind of get over the psychological hurdle of pulling the trigger on these new strategies I'm learning.
Yeah, that's really good advice. I'm also remembering that Carlos mentioned, or sorry, that Sean mentioned this being a half and half game. So there's also PLO. And I mean, I was kind of assuming a no limit context with what I said, but like other than overbetting, it all applies to PLO as well. You still want to be making the largest three bets that you can when you're in position. You still want to be looking for opportunities to cap your opponents. You might have to think a little bit more about how to grow the pot to get to the point where you can make large bets on later streets. So, given that you're going to be restricted to potting it on, say, the flop or the turn, looking for opportunities to get a check raise in, for instance, like check raising is going to become a more important part of your strategy when you have nutty hands and nutty draws so that you can like force more money into the pot early and set yourself up to be able to make big bets later.
Definitely more three betting, more check raising, and for bigger sizes than you're used to because stacks are deeper. Also, I would say try to play a lot of pots against this guy who wants to run it twice on the river. He seems like a good person to be playing pots against. Try to get position on him if that's something that isn't frowned upon, if you're like really kind of pushing the issue on that. And another piece of advice I have is when you're playing this exploitively, you need to have as much information as you can on the worst player. So, although you don't have access to a HUD in this game or a database, you can just kind of, focus all your attention on that one guy and just kind of create your own notebook database. On him, even if you're like, I know this is an online game, but you can just, I don't know, pull up Notepad and take notes on everything this guy does, whether you're in the hand with him or not, because he's the one making the most mistakes. So having more information on him specifically is going to be very valuable. I would even go so far as to screen record myself playing this and then go back and study the video later. I think that's going to be not as good as a database, but it's going to be better than just like, taking notes in a notepad or just trying to remember things. So that's another piece of advice I have.
Yeah, I think that's really good. Anything else for Sean?
Yeah, give me a seat to this game. Oh, never mind.
I
There's a PLO part. Never mind.
think it would be worth it for you to learn the basics.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. That's probably where these stacks get built, actually. Like I've seen some pretty bad play in PLO games where people are like potting it and getting stacks in with hands that they really shouldn't. And that's probably how this game goes from like 50 bigs to 1,000 bigs, like the mistakes that people are making in the PLO portion of this game.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, Sean, hopefully that advice from Andrew and I is enough to help you find some more exploits in this game that seem pretty ripe for it. So, good luck.
Yes, thank you for writing, Sean. Always good to hear from you. Our next question comes from, unfortunately, I lost the name of the person who is submitting this hand, but it's in. It's a spot that I want to talk about because I think it touches on a concept that a lot of people, I don't know if misunderstand is quite the right word, but need to contend with. So this is a hand from day two of the Colossus, the WSOP Colossus event in 2026. And our correspondent says, according to the screen, we just dropped to three players off the money bubble, but they have not yet called hand for hand. So this is a very large field tournament, obviously the Colossus. So three off the bubble is like very likely this is going to be the last hand before they're in the money. So we're eight-handed at the table. I have an average stack of 28 blinds. It folds to the big stack, and the hijack was over 150 blinds. The big stack opens to 2.5 blinds. Small blind with 40 big blinds calls. This seemed to be a solid, straightforward player that bullied effectively with his stack, but never got too out of hand. And then I, our correspondent, looked down at 6-7 offsuit in the big blind. I thought about folding, but I have min cashed a lot of these $1,000 to $1,500 events before and challenged myself to aim to be less risk averse and take chances to try and make a final table. I also thought that now, before the money bubble burst, was the time when moves can be made to help collect chips, but this dynamic will disappear after the bubble bursts. So I called. We'll talk more about how this plays out, but first, I want to address this question of like playing to make a final table versus playing to make a min cash. And this, I think, is best. Like, there's important context to have here. And I think a lot of people never ask themselves the question of like, why are you playing poker? Or like, what are your goals? And yeah, you can say I'm in it to make money. And for some people, that's more true than for others. I don't think it's 100% true for anyone. Like, I think if literally the only thing you cared about was making money, you could better monetize your time than playing poker. That's probably true of pretty much all of us. So there's
Yes.
something else that you're getting out of poker besides just making money. To the extent that you care about just maximizing the amount of money that you win on average, fold is very much the play here. That min cash is quite significant. And like in an event like the Colossus, you are nowhere near the final table. So the idea that like calling here, e like even if you called here and tripled up, you would still be nowhere near making the final table. So the idea that like calling here is going to substantially increase your odds of making the final table, it's just like that's, yeah, th like th the idea of like, should I be playing for the win or playing for a min cash? That's not primarily a matter of personal preference. Like they both matter. They both contribute to your EV at any given moment. And an important skill, to the extent that you care about like maximizing your EV in a poker tournament, an important skill is understanding how much to care about one versus the other in any given situation. And when you're literally a hand off the bubble is the time when you should care a lot about making a min cash. Getting eliminated here, you're costing yourself a min cash. Like you could definitely fold into the money. So if you get eliminated right now, you're costing yourself a min cash. And the question you have to ask yourself is, if I'm risking elimination, like what is it worth to and obviously it's not risking elimination just by calling, but what's going to happen when you call is you're going to get into a lot of situations. Like 6-7 offsuit is not often going to make a hand that you feel real confident about. So you're going to end up doing stuff like making thin calls or semi-bluffing or just doing a lot of folding. A lot of folding is going to be the right play. When you make stuff
Right.
like straight draws or, middle pair, you're just going to end up needing to check fold those hands a lot or like call flop bet and fold the turn. You're just going to like bleed a lot of chips because you have such a big risk premium on you right now that like you can't take the risk of contesting pots when you have that kind of medium stuff and it's like potentially putting your survival at risk. So you need to anticipate like I'm not going to be able to play big pots with this hand, and the best thing you can do then is just get out of the way and fold it immediately. And there's nothing like cowardly about that. I don't know that that's exactly what this correspondent is saying, but I think some people have this idea that it's like nitty to be playing for a min cash. And if you're playing for a min cash from hand one, yeah, that's nitty. Like that's not the way to approach the tournament either. But when you're on the literal bubble, you should be thinking quite a lot about making sure that you get a min cash, especially when your stack is not that big to begin with. And when your hand, like I wouldn't fold aces here. I wouldn't even fold like I might not even fold 7-6 suited. That might actually be a correct fold for the same reason that 7-6 offsuit is. But like, this is not a hand that is all that tempting to play, even if we weren't on the bubble. I mean, I think it is a call if we're not on the bubble, but like, it's not that good. So you're not giving up a lot by folding this. And I think also the idea that like, you don't cover these other players. So you're not really in a position to like bully them or make moves on them. Stealing on the bubble is not just about sort of like who has the biggest cojones. I mean, it's mostly about who has the biggest stack. Like that's the people with more chips just get to take chips from people with less. It's not a matter of, someone is making mistakes or is overfolding because they're too nitty. It's just the structure of how a tournament works that like the big stacks get to pick on the, short and medium stacks when we're on the bubble. And from a pure EV perspective, the best thing that you can do is fold. I mean, if you really care about making the final table, you are very slightly increasing your chances of making the final table by calling here, but like infinitesimal. Like it's really not a meaningful difference compared to like how much it's going to cost you if you get eliminated on this hand.
Yeah, it's like we can't state strongly enough how your chances of making the final table are not affected at all by your playlist had. Like, honestly, I would venture to say if you could somehow win this hand and become chip leader of this tournament, you're still not a favorite to make the final table.
Oh, for
Like,
sure, yeah.
there's 2,000, this tournament paid roughly 2,200 spots. Whoever the chip leader was when you got into the money, very unlikely made the final table. It's like you can't, like, the final table is so far away that you can't even really be thinking about that now. The way you give yourself the best chance of making the final table is by making the most plus EV decisions you can. Now, what some people will argue is you can increase the amount of money you make by making the most dollar EV decisions, and that could hurt your chances of making the final table because sometimes you're making decisions that cause you to make more money as opposed to make more chips. But even if you may, like, if you kind of shun dollar EV and you just focused on chip EV, it's still gonna have you be pretty careful in a spot like this. Like you said, Andrew, these other two players cover you. Also, this hand and a heads up pot is going to perform a lot better than this hand in a multi-way pot. The fact that you are in position versus the small blind helps a little bit. But I imagine if you were out of position to both of these players, this hand would just be a chippy V fold pre. With you being in position to the small blind, maybe it's a chippy V call. But again, if you could look at, how much it's worth in terms of like how many big blinds you're making doing this, it's not really changing your life here much at all. Now, if you then say to yourself, okay, I do want to take ICM into account to some degree. That's when I think it just becomes a big mistake to defend this hand because we can't even see sims that, like, I don't, like, there's nothing in GTO Wizard. Honestly, I don't know if there's anything in any solver or solver adjacent tool that I've seen that covers 16,000 player fields. If there were, and we look at those ranges as opposed to like maybe some ranges you see in a 1,000 player field on GTO Wizard, I imagine it's going to be drastically different. So, yeah, I mean, I really can't think of a stronger way to say this, but you're not drastically increasing your chances of winning the tournament by playing this hand. You do that by, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, Andrew, I think this might be correct. You give yourself the best chance of winning the tournament by making the best plus EV decisions, even plus chip EV decisions, even if it's not dollar EV. And I'm not even sure this is a good plus chippy V decision.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, until you get down to like the final two or three tables, and then, if you were really concerned about making the final table as opposed to winning, then, you might start kind of playing as though you were on the bubble. But yeah, at this stage of the tournament, just making the most plus chippy V decisions is how you would maximize your chances of making the final table. If you had a $10 million bet about making the final table of this tournament, then it might make sense to, this would still not be a deviation, I think, but like, there might be some reason to like focus a little bit more on trying to make the final table if you were getting that kind of an overlay to do it. But like that's truly what the number, like that's not an exaggeration. That's truly what the number would need to be.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you said that because I forgot that. Like most people say, I'm playing for the win. I kind of had that in my mind, but basically he said, I'm playing for the final table, which does kind of take into some ICM account as you get closer to that point. So yeah, that's true. So what that tells me is if you're playing to make the final table as opposed to playing to win, then you don't even want to take a pure cheap chip EV spot here. So You might want to, think less about ICM than someone who's just trying to maximize the amount of money they make. But that's going to be somewhere between standard ICM and chip EV. Is not going to be all the way to chip EV. So I don't know how to account for that difference. This seems like a question for like Tombos. I think he might be better at, simulating these massive field type things. I know I've never seen anything like this, but if I can imagine what this looks like in my mind, it's going to be pretty tight. Like I can imagine even folding a decent number of suited hands here. So to go with a trashy offsuit hand just feels like a significant mistake in my opinion.
Yeah, I think this is really not close. Our correspondent does call, however, and the flop comes 998 rainbow. So our hero has 7-6 offsuit. Flop is 998 rainbow. Small blind checks. Oh, so we're playing heads up now against small blind, big blind, and the hijack. Small blind checks. Our hero also checks, which I think is, well, I don't know, maybe that's what we're talking about. Do you think this is a check? We flopped an open-ended straight draw. Is there a case for leading here?
I think in theory, so the opener was from the hijack. So, but he's also a big stack on the bubble. So, generally, the way I decide who has range advantage and therefore who gets to bet in spots like this is going to be I want to look at the bottom of the offsuit portion of the range. So, normally, the hijack isn't opening offsuit nines. And when I say offsuit nines, I mean offsuit hands with a nine kicker, like 10 nine off, jack nine off, those sort of hands. That's more like a cutoff opening range. But when the hijack has 150 big blinds on the bowl of the Colossus, he might be able to open like half the deck here. So all that, what I'm saying here is that we can't say that the hijack doesn't have enough nines in their range. And I think that kind of makes it harder for us to lead in a spot like this. I think he has a number of nines. I would not be shocked if he also has a number of eights. Obviously, he's going to have Jack 10. Hell, he may even have 7-6. So the parts of the hands that hit this board, I think, are in both ranges. In fact, he may have, well, I was going to say he may have more nines than us because he should be opening more nines than we're defending, but we've kind of like chosen to defend a wider range than we should. So that might negate things, but then we're also at a positional disadvantage. So I honestly don't think this is sort of board where we get to do leading. If this is more like 6-6-5, then I think the hijack is not going to have enough offsuit hands with a six kicker in that range to that's when we can start doing some leading. But I don't think that's the case here.
Cool, that makes sense. So our correspondent does correctly check. The hijack bets three big blinds into a pot of 8.5. Small blind folds. Let's think about what do we make of hijack's bet here? Do we think this is just, if he is this ultra aggressive chip leader who's been opening as wide as you suggested, should he just be c betting any two cards here?
I don't know if he should, but I think he probably will.
Okay.
I think the average person doesn't take into account how wide their pre-flop range is. So what normally happens in post-flop ICM, and this is like the most extreme version of post-flop ICM, the big stack opener gets to open way more hands than they usually open. And the short stack big blind defender has to defend a much tighter range they normally defend. So the range advantage oftentimes can flip. Like I said, on a 6-6-5 board, the range advantage may have flipped so much that the big blind gets to lead. Like I don't think that's the case here, but if the opener still has the range advantage, is not that big. So therefore, he doesn't just get to c-bet range. But most of these players don't recognize that. And so one exploit that you can have here, if the big stack is opening way more hands than they're supposed to, and not recognizing that they don't have a huge range advantage on this board, and then c-betting all those extra hands that they open, then that opens up an exploit where the big blind player can now check raise a lot as an exploit. It's now, proper ICM strategy is going to kind of put some cap on that. But if you're kind of throwing that out the window and you're playing more of a chippy V style, then I imagine you can probably go pretty crazy with check raises in a spot like this versus a player who is like opening too many hands and then c-betting range. If that's the case, I think big blind can do a lot of check raising in this spot.
Our hero does check raise. It's just a minimum check raise. Do you think that's a good size to use given the plan or the objective?
I do, because the opener is his range is still uncapped. Like, although he has a very wide range that's going to miss a lot on this board, and when he if he c-betting the entire range, which honestly, three bigs into a pot of 8.5 on a 998 board, maybe in theory this bet size is even too big. I could be wrong. I know pair of boards, usually the c-bet is smaller, but maybe this particular pair of board that is like super wet and dynamic, maybe that maybe the size is fine. So I won't read too much into that. But what I will say is, if he's c-betting all the hands he's opening, but he's still uncapped because he obviously has pocket eights in his range. He's got pocket nines in his range. He's got, I was going to mention the overpairs. He's so deep, honestly, that I think if he's got something like pocket aces, he's not going to like fold it. Like, if we check raise, bet turn, and bet river, he may not even fold that because we can't really hurt him that much. Maybe that's up for debate. But what I'm getting at here is, if he's uncapped, we don't want to check raise for a large size into an uncapped range. So even if we are going to play this more of a chippy V way where we're going to like try to run this bluff, we kind of got to leave some ammunition for later streets. So we can't go so big right now. So I think you either check raise small like our correspondent did, or alternatively, you could call and then maybe check raise the turn or lead the turn, and that way try to save some of your chips to put in a big bet on turns or rivers. If you check raise too big now, then you don't really have the ammunition to do that later. So if you're going to check raise, I kind of like this size. Even though you probably don't have much fold equity immediately on the flop, you're kind of saving your bullets to fire on turns and rivers. So I'm on board with this check raise size.
Well, and the nice thing with a checker is that this is this small, right? So at this point, there's 11.5 in the pot after the bet, and we're risking six. So we also don't need that much fold equity to make this profitable. And if we do think the villain is betting any two, we probably can get them off of some of their, like, our correspondent mentions random overcards, but like they don't even necessarily have overcards. Like they can have king three offsuit, right? Like there's stuff that they can have that's like that's not even overcard. So I think there's like plenty that we can get them off of with a small check raise, because they are if they are making the mistake of c-betting their entire wide range, they're just going to have a ton of garbage. But yeah, I do think it's important to keep in mind there's also a lot that they're not folding, including maybe a lot of like two overcard, like a ace queen or something very plausibly continuing. Certainly they're going to have a lot of straight draws themselves on this board. And this is where I think our correspondent gets a little confused because the turn brings a six, which now pairs our hero. So the board is 9986, our hero holding 7-6, 20.5 blinds in the pot, 19.5 blinds in our hero's stack. And he says, turn is a six, giving me a pair, which has me ahead of his overcards, but I don't consider enough showdown value to defend two streets out of position. I had assumed my clickback folded that part of his range. And so I think just that general assumption that like you've already folded out all of his overcards by raising the flop, and now your hand, I mean, I agree that you maybe don't want, like, I wouldn't feel good about putting the rest of my stack in here if he were the one betting, but that's more because of an ICM thing. Like if we were just playing for chips, which is the way you were acting when you called preflop, that you're just playing for chips, then like, yeah, you have an SPR of one, you have a pair and an open ended straight draw. Like you, it's fine to put the rest of the money in without fold equity, like even if he's the one betting. And here, like I do think there's still a decent amount that you're ahead of. So what ends up happening are our correspondent jams. He's saying that he's pretending that he has a nine. And I mean, A, I'm not sure that's what you should actually do if you have a nine, but B, I don't like, even if the plan was to try to put stacks in, I think like turning a pair ought to change that plan. It really changes what our hand is and how much we, I'm not convinced we're getting a lot of better hands to fold.
Yeah, he says, I'm trying to pretend I don't have a nine there, and therefore make my opponent think I do have a nine. Like, you know, this thing where people be like, you know, they'll sigh and, oh my God, I can't believe this is
Oh,
happening.
I see.
Okay, I'm all in. And then you're thinking like, oh, that guy definitely has a nine. So that's what he was going for here. But like you said, I don't think it's necessary. I think, like you said, you nailed it. If you're trying to play this in a chip EV way and you made this very small check raise on the flop, which is not going to fold out every hand that is behind a six, because even if you want to say he folds some overcards, is he folding Queen Jack? Is he folding Ace King? Is he folding Ace Seven? No, like there's a decent number of overcards in his range that he's not folding because they interact with his board. But I would argue that in this scenario, this guy's probably not even folding something like King Queen, or trying to think of one that's very uncoordinated with the board, like Ace Queen. Like, honestly, I can't think of too many overcards that he is folding. The only things I think that you might get him off of are those hands that you mentioned, Andrew, like a king three sort of hand. So what that means is once we get to this turn, we're good against a good portion of his range. And it doesn't really make sense to bet your hand again on the turn if you're trying to increase your chances of winning this tournament and just, you know, making the most chips possible. You now want to allow him to bluff with those overcards, not fold them out. So check call is what I think you should do on the turn if you want to play this in a chip EV way.
Yeah, I think this is just kind of a matter of like giving the villain credit for too strong of a range from the get-go, just like immediately on the flop, only talking about him having overcards and not thinking about like the overcards are not the bottom of his range on the flop. So it makes sense to assume like, oh, I've already folded out the bottom of his range. So my like, I mean, I think it's good that you're not just automatically assuming because you turned a pair, you have showdown value. Like that is another mistake that people often make is they
Right.
overestimate how much showdown value they have just because you turn a pair. But here, I think you're underestimating how wide his range is.
Yeah.
And consequently, like when you correctly assume that he folds the bottom of his range, you're not making the right assumptions about what the bottom of his range actually is.
Yeah, very well said. And lastly, I would say, even if you're gonna turn this into a bluff, name your target. What hand is gonna fold to this that's better than a six? Like, he's not folding pocket sevens. That's open-ended. He's probably not folding eight. He's not folding tens plus. So even if you don't have a lot of showdown value here, you really can't do a lot about it. I mean, we started 28 big. So I guess it depends on how big of a bet this is on the turn. Am I, okay, so he says it's
It's
roughly a
a
pot
pot-sized
size
bet.
bet. Yeah, he's not folding better than a six to a pot size bet. You got to remember, this guy has infinite chips. and he's not folding. Like the worst hand he can have here is like what, ace eight? Maybe like queen eight is like the worst hand, maybe jack eight. I don't think even those are folding to this. So yeah, feels like a bluff with no target. And also a bluff that doesn't necessarily need to bluff because it does have some sort of showdown value.
Yeah, it kind of feels like our correspondent just like locked into the idea of bluffing from the flop and then didn't never got out of that gear. It was just kind of like, or even from pre-flop, just kind of got in the idea of like, I'm gonna make a move, and then just like never really got out of that mode.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what this really sounds like to me is that he kind of wanted to bubble this thing. It's like he kind of got into his mind that I've cashed enough of these, been there, done that. I want to give myself a shot to win. The best time to do that is on the bubble, and I don't care. I want to double or bust. And he's like way too willing to bust in the spot and not thinking about how likely it is he's going to double in a spot like this. And I know this feeling because I've done this, but not in the Colossus with 1,600 people. Like this is the sort of thing I'll do if I like win a seat to a free roll I really don't want to play. And I might do it on the first hand of the tournament. It's like I'm looking for a spot to double a bust. Or let's say if I'm in a mystery bounty and the bounties are in where there's like a where the bounties are worth like half the starting stack, like the Hydra on the global. I'll kind of do this sort of thing where it doesn't matter if I double a bust because there's so much like extra equity in the pot. But obviously that's not the case here because he doesn't even have these guys covered. But it just really feels to me that he wanted to go skydiving here and he really didn't care if his parachute opened or not. That's what this feels like.
Yeah, and unfortunately, he smacked into the ground hard because he jammed and got called by 10-7 suited, which turned a straight and left him drawing to just a couple of outs. So this again kind of to get to my point of like the villain's range on the flop was not just overcards, and you know if he has 10-7, surely he has Queen Jack and Jack 10 and Queen 10 and like a lot of other stuff that you're ahead of and that you would you don't need to jam into.
Well, the good news is he didn't necessarily bubble with this many people in the tournament. There's some chance somebody at a different table, a couple of people at a different table busted before him.
He says, the table is shocked as I shamefully collect my stuff and leave, mumbling about having just blown up myself on the money bubble of a bracelet event. As I leave, I hear the announcer say that they will be going hand for hand.
Max Payne, Max Payne. Oh my God. Yeah, that's. I mean, it seems like he recognized this as a possibility and he accepted that ahead of time. So I don't know if he feels this way in game, but there's some people who just want to feel the excitement of this sort of spot, whether they win or lose. And either way, they're fine. At least it wasn't like boring and weakly folding my way into the money. But honestly, that is what you're supposed to do in a spot like this.
Yeah. Well, I hope that that is what our correspondent was looking for because that's what he ended up with. Thank you for writing. I do think it's an interesting question that, like I said, is I don't know that there, I mean we've been talking a lot about sort of how much you're giving up by not getting the min cash, and I do think it's good to understand that. But it's also good to understand that like Carlos and I are professional poker players, so like we are more in it for the money than some people are, and. You know, I do think it's a legitimate thing to say, I maybe not at this exact stage of the tournament, but to have other goals when you're playing, including like it's really important to me to make day two. It's really important to me to to try to make a final table or even to play. Like I just care a lot about winning a bracelet. I don't care about anything else. You know, like I don't think those are illegitimate goals. goals to have, but I do think you want to have that conversation with yourself about what your goals are before you're on the bubble. Like, I think you want to come into the term, even come into the series with that sense and have it influence a lot of your decisions. Because part of my concern here, and I mean, it's sort of wrapped up with how the hand is played, is that, like, I don't know how much there was just like maybe some boredom that was playing into this and some frustration that was playing into this. And then there's kind of like a bully demon, who's whispering in your ear, like, play for the win, play for the win, make a move. These guys are chumps, like that. That's kind of what I imagine happening here.
I think this is the best piece of actionable advice I can give to this correspondent. Your approach to this hand is fine, just not on the bubble. Like this thought process, if you want to take this thought process back like four levels and play this way before the bubble starts, then it makes a lot more sense. Because if you do that, what ends up happening either is you either bust before the bubble. I would say preferably do this at the end of day one, so you don't have to waste your time coming back to day two if it doesn't work out. Like if you do this earlier, before the bubble starts, you either bust and you can go on and do it in a different tournament, or it works out. And then you wind up on the bubble as the guy with 150 bigs. And then now you can like open 10-7 suited and play for the win in the way that he was doing without risking your chance of cashing if it goes wrong. So this, like, I understand this idea of not wanting to be focused on min cashing. Like you've already done that. And I always talk about how important I think milestones are in poker. You want to kind of get that out of the way. And once you get it out of the way, you now feel like, okay, now I've freed myself up to play for the win. But what you have to learn is when to execute that. The stone bubble is not the time to do it when you're a medium stack or a short stack. The time to do that is when you're a medium stack or a short stack during what I would call the pre-bubble stage. You take your chances there because if it doesn't work out, it's not an ICM mistake in the same way as punting on a bubble is. And there's some future game implication there because if it works out, now you come into the bubble with the big stack and then you can take advantage of everyone else who's kind of folding their money, folding their way into the money because they're, I'm going to do air quotes and say too focused on ICM, but that's like correct. But when other people are playing in ways where you didn't want to play in this hand, you get to be the one running over the bubble like this guy with 150 bigs tried to do. So I think that's going to work because what we could tell this guy is just like, hey, this was a mistake. Don't do this again. That's not going to resonate with someone who wants to play for the win or play for the final table. But telling them that that instinct is good, but you just have to choose a better time to do it, I think that advice is more likely to be acted on than just telling him to like fold pre in a spot like this.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and I think that's very good advice. It's just like know when to be a bully, or kind of when does it make sense to take calculated risks versus when are you really giving up a lot by taking that same risk.
And I'm speaking from experience. So if you want to hear more about this, go back to old episodes of this show entitled Car Loose and Car Looser, because that's when I kind of developed this same sort of mentality of I'm tired of just min cashing all the time. And honestly, once I developed that and start taking these calculated risks earlier during the pre-bubble stage, my results really did take off. So I cashed less often, but when I did cash, I had more final tables and was even able to win a bracelet. So I would say you're not crazy for feeling this way. You just have to execute it better.
Thank you for sharing your pain with us. Hopefully others were able to learn from it. Let's do one more question from Timothy. And this is a good time to say that all of these questions were submitted to us on Thinking Poker Daily, which is our listener-supported show on Patreon. So if you enjoy hearing Carlos and me talk poker strategy, you can support the show and hear us talk poker strategy 7 days a week by signing up at patreon.com/thinkingpokerdaily. And for absolutely no cost, you can get 2 of those days free. So just joining us at patreon.com/thinkingpokerdaily, you don't have to put up any money and you'll immediately get access to the Saturday and Sunday episodes. And then if you enjoy those and you want to support us further, you can get episodes of the show up to 7 days a week. This hand comes from Timothy, who played it in a 4-4 game in Prague. A background for this hand is that Villain is a rig who is good but not the best and has been talking all night about how I'm so tight, I never bluff, making fun of other people when they call my bets because he always has it, etc. So he's been making fun of Timothy, accusing him of being too tight. And Timothy says, tonight I've been folding a lot because of bad card distribution, but he doesn't know I've gotten away with some out of line stuff against him in the past few sessions where the hands didn't go to showdown because he's overfolding so much against me. I believe he is completely sincere in his read on me, and I don't think this is any kind of reverse psychology leveling war on his part. I have no idea why he is informing me of his strategy, but kudos to him for doing so.
I love it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that it seems bad, but I will say that, like, I talk to a lot of people where this gets under their skin. When someone accuses them of being too tight, they will go out of their way to prove that person wrong. And it's sort of like, I'm going to show them that I can play bad hands and show them that I will bluff. Like, they will play badly to try to prove these people wrong. So, I don't know that that's what this person is doing, but like, I am very familiar with that phenomenon. People do not like to be called nits or, be told that they're too tight.
Right.
Onto the hand, the straddle is on. So straddle to 8 euros. We're about 100 straddles effective. Our hero raises to ace king off in the cutoff, and the villain 3 bets from the big blind. Timothy says all options are on the table in theory. I can raise, call, and jam some at equilibrium. I'm not sure how to adjust versus this guy's very unbalanced strategy, where if I breathe at the pot, he might fold. I think there's a big case for trapping kings and aces, but 4-betting queens and jacks to get him off of his ace x and king x bluffs, and maybe even ace king offsuit if he's exploiting that much. Given the stack depth, I think I would want to overdo it with all the biggie smalls in my range, not just some frequency of calling versus 4-betting with ace 5 suited, but pure 4-betting. Not just 25% 4-bet with ace 4 suited, but 100%. Ace King offsuit is an odd hand because I never really mind getting the fold. Even with this dominated ace X, he still has 30%. And if I can get him to fold a pocket pair or 2 live cards, that's a great outcome. I figured I should still 4-bet Ace King offsuit some, but I rolled high and put in the 4-bet and he snap folds. So the question here really is just like, often solvers like to trap with Ace King when they're in position. They don't do a lot of 4-betting in position because they want it to, just have the advantage of playing after the flop and also keep in, like, as Timothy mentions, a lot of the big blinds 3 bets are supposed to be like ace x and king x hands that are dominated by ace king. So there's less value in making those hands fold pre-flop. But if we think this person is like overly tight, does it make sense to just 4-bet and try to collect that fold equity immediately?
Yes. Like anytime you can 4-bet and get a fold, you should do it. Like even with pocket kings, like the only hand I'm going to be kind of sad if the guy folds if I have aces. And it's not like you didn't win a decent pot here. Like the guy 3-bet you in a straddle pot. Like that's a lot of money to take down without a showdown. So if I thought this guy was going to play way too tight versus 4-bets, I would just 4-bet him with range.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. And not only do I think he's playing too tight against 4-bets, he's probably 3-betting too wide, right? Because he thinks you're a huge nit and he thinks you're going to like overfold to his 3-bets. So you're not just exploiting his response to your 3-bet, you're exploiting the fact that the 3-bet itself is probably already too wide. And raising is the most important way of doing that. It punishes him much more than calling does for 3-betting. Like he's probably 3-betting a lot more hands than our 2 live cards against Ace King than he's supposed to be in theory. And so, you do value getting the fold equity against those hands.
Yeah, I think this is probably a spot where if we treat the straddle as the big blind, Timothy raised for three straddles or three big blinds, and this guy probably made it 12 to 15. So we pick up 12 to 15 straddles in one hand, or if we call it big blinds, 12 to 15 big blinds in one hand. Like, that's a hell of a win rate for 100 hands.
Yeah.
So to pick that up in one hand and to be able to do it consistently against a guy that, like you said, Andrew, is three betting more than they should, and then folding more than they should versus four bets. Like, this guy is doing wonders for your win rate. Just like, try to recreate this spot as much as possible and never, ever, ever show a hand unless you want to show aces or kings. Like, I would encourage him to keep thinking I'm a nit. But outside of that, don't, like, this is like the golden goose. So just keep getting these eggs and never tell anybody, and hope he doesn't listen to
Awesome. Thank you, Timothy, for writing. Thank you for your support on patreon.com/thinkingpokerdaily. And please remember also to check out gtodojo.com/thinking. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Of a car, the light of the fair passage of a bill.